We don't get to start over every time we want to remake the world. We bear the whole history of those power relations.
There are certain instruments that are existing in our contemporary international political and legal world that are actually exploiting and reproducing the old inequalities of the world and entrenching those inequalities.
You know, it doesn't matter how small your town is, you're still part of a global economy of war.
This is the second full episode of Human Rights in a Burning World, produced by Solidarity House Cooperative, in partnership with the Common Good Foundation, and sponsored by the World Peace Through Law section of the Washington State Bar Association in the United States. I'm Matt Stannard. Although obviously all our episodes in this series have political implications, this episode is a little more politically edgy. It's going to mention topics like colonialism and capitalism, and the scholars on these interviews have very firm opinions about those things. And not everyone agrees with those opinions, so let's just get that out of the way. The reason we're taking this particular trip through third world approaches to international law movement, or TWAIL, and discussing what might be called the historical geography of violence, is that we want to interrupt our celebration and cheerleading of international legal practice, and remind ourselves that we don't know everything, and that we have a lot of historical failure and fallout to take care of and maybe even atone for. Most of the series will deal with particular cases or phenomena, trade in vulnerable human and non-human bodies, repressive governments, irresponsible corporations, you know, case studies of violators and the heroic practitioners who fight them. In this episode, we're going to listen to a couple of scholars offer their explanations on why these things keep happening. And there are pretty mixed feelings about how we can solve these systemic problems and what kind of approaches we need to take to do it. I promise they'll be thought-provoking. So, a little about a movement called Third World Approaches to International Law, and then a long conversation with Tamil Ananthivinayagan. Tamil teaches at Griffith College in Dublin, and he was born in Germany. TWAIL has only been around since about the 1990s, but the theories and arguments of third and fourth world anti-colonialist thought date back much further. TWAIL sees traditional and contemporary international law as perpetuating the structures, assumptions, and outcomes of European colonialism. So now I'll introduce you to Tamil Ananthivinayagan. The most interesting thing he's done, in my own opinion, is something he only briefly mentions in this interview, his work as a housing reform advocate in Germany. I geek out on housing reform and tenants' rights and stuff like that. The story of how his parents fled Sri Lanka and ended up in Germany is also gripping, and we don't talk about it here. Tamil is someone I want to get to know better, but my recent conversation with him was an overview of this unique anti-colonialist critical legal tradition, and whether it would result in paralysis and inaction, or perhaps offers the potential for deep reforms in our international legal system.
My name is Dr. Tamil Ananthivinayagan. I am a lecturer in international law at Griffith College in Dublin, Ireland. A bit more elaborating on my background. I have studied and taught in Germany. I was born and raised in Germany. I'm one of those new Germans who came to the surface of this planet. My father and my mother came to Germany in the 80s as refugees. My father himself was one of the most famous politicians back in Sri Lanka, was in prison for 7 years for his freedom struggle for the Tamils, which are a minority in Sri Lanka, fighting against the repression of the Buddhist singular majority in the country. My father and my mother fled to Germany with the support and help of Amnesty International, which was very vocal in the case of my father while he was in prison and afterwards. When he and my mother reunited after a short separation in Germany. I myself, as the product of love, was born in the country. I grew up in the country. I studied in Germany and worked after my law studies at the University of Bonn and Marburg. I worked as a research assistant and parliamentary assistant to a very famous German Labour MP from the German Labour Party, the SPD, the Sozialdemokratische Partei Deutschlands. I've worked for the Friedrich Ebert Stiftung and also for the German Health Ministry. But shortly towards the end of my stay in Germany, if you want, I worked as a junior lawyer in the German Tenants Association, taking on cases against rising rents and landlords who are taking very extraordinary and very robust actions against vulnerable tenants. Mm-hmm. So that was like my last position that I held in Germany, and then I was kind of interested and pursue my actual interest, and that was human rights law. So I transferred to Maastricht in the Netherlands to study international human rights law and international law, finished my master's there, and shortly after I had applied for a PhD position in Galway at the Irish Center for Human Rights, where I worked as a fellow at the Irish Center, but also as a research assistant to the then director of the Irish Center for Human Rights, a renowned human rights activist and academic with the name Michael O'Flaherty, who is now the head of the Fundamental Rights Agency, basically the human rights agency of the European Union. After finishing the PhD, thankfully, last year in January, I transferred to Griffith College in Dublin, which is one of the major universities in Ireland. It's a private university where I have taught so far international humanitarian law, international human rights law, international criminal law, but also public international law. And perhaps to conclude with one or two sentences in relation to my person, my biography, I have a strong focus on something that is called TWILE. It stands for Third World Approaches to International Law, which takes a very critical stand towards contemporary international law, because international law as it stands in the view of us TWILers is that international law is a product of colonialism, and the old visions and the old heritage of colonialism are reproduced through contemporary measures and faces of international law, but also reinforced by new international instruments, which are holding people from the global south still under a very long distance and alienate them from actual real participation, and actually hinder international law to become truly international and to serve the many and not only the few. This is where I'm coming from. I started as a very enthusiastic human rights lawyer, but eventually I've taken the view that we need many things to change in contemporary international law, international human rights law, and many other fields of international law to eventually serve the majority of the world and to overcome extreme poverty, to overcome inequality, but first and foremost to ensure human rights and ensure equal participation to law, the institutions, and the development of policy practice. It is possible to have a conversation on TWILE in an elevator, provided that there are 90 plus floors and the elevator is approaching very slow.
Of course.
In that circumstance, it's possible to talk about Weil.
If the riders in the elevator are students of international law or scholars of international law or scholars of third world activism, maybe you could do it in 60 floors.
Exactly, yeah. With very nice background music of Marvin Gaye, perhaps. So it is possible to do and have these kind of conversations, yes. And you are also right that we can characterize or try to pin it down to certain axioms. And the contemporary view that the particular heads and authorities in this field take, to name a few, there's Anthony Angi, who was the most renowned international law academic, but in particular the leader of the Twile movement at the time. He is teaching at Utah as well as in Singapore. He is one of the best international scholars in the world. And moreover, we have another person called Makau Mutua. And of course, another person who we have also have to mention is B.S. Chimney. And finally, Muthu Kumaraswamy Sornaraja. And many, many more. And I think the academic threat that meets all of them and that combines all of them and the common value that we share and that we can explain in an elevator conversation is that international law today is reinforcing inequalities that stem from previous colonial practices that have translated into international institutions like the League of Nations and that were reproduced and manifested in the United Nations. In particular, if you look at the United Nations Security Council, which is locating and navigating the fate of the world. So to this end, at the end of the day, Twile is about discussing the power imbalance that we have and that we want to restructure the view of international law, that we have to achieve global justice through international law, to make international law actually a law that is accessible to even certain areas of the world that have not benefited from the decolonization process as it is today. So at the end of the day, if I have to, you know, finish it off an elevator discussion shortly before we step out of the elevator, it is about talking and fighting through Twile for a larger share of participation of formerly colonized states in the global governance through justice.
You have been concerned lately about applying that method and that worldview to the phenomenon that's going on in an accelerated way in the world right now, characterized in one way by rising nationalism, nationalist authoritarianism, a phenomenon that seems to me to be very global and cross-cultural, although obviously manifested differently. But when you see the Philippines and you see Brazil and then you see Hungary and, countries from, in very different situations and stages of development, maybe, but with an eerie kind of commonality of nationalism and authoritarianism. I get to hear a lot about what first world scholars think of this and what first world politics thinks of this. I am, as are so many in the West, underexposed, even as students of international law, to what a third world approach to this is. And so, you ask whether international law can deal with this accelerated trend and what role Twail has to play. What are your answers to that?
Well, indeed, I agree. We see rising authoritarianism all around the world. We thought, you know, the vote in Britain in 2015, and then shortly after the election of Mr. Donald Trump to the White House, marked the first and hopefully last moments of the rise of a certain nationalist attitude. But we have rather seen that this is a fire that is dangerous and that has caught fire in different parts of the world, spreading from one continent to the next. We have to look at the recent election of Bolsonaro in Brazil. We can also look at the current president of the Philippines, Duterte, as you just mentioned correctly. But it's also a person like Narendra Modi as a prime minister of India. But moreover, if we then again focus on this continent, namely Europe, you see very tragic and also very concerning moments to see the rise of the right to power. I'm mentioning in particular countries like Hungary. We have to mention a country like Italy that has seen a fascist path, and we do see a person like Matteo Salvini at the very front of power in the country as vice prime minister, but most likely he is actually the driving force in the country. We also see the rise of the right in my own home country, namely Germany, and we have never imagined that there would be a far-right party sitting in the German parliament, in the Reichstag, after 1945. And unfortunately, we see that the sentence of Mark Twain seems to be right, namely that history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And we see that we haven't learned from the past, and rather we see new leaders of the right, of the nationalist movement, in the parliaments all around the world. Mm-hmm. We've also seen this, unfortunately, in Spain, where also another country has had a fascist past, and just recently in a provincial election, the Vox Party came to gain significant power in that part of Spain, and they are predicted to also dominate politics most likely at the next general elections. So altogether, if we look at this different developments all around the world, and I'm probably also not mentioning many other parts of the world and countries of the world, we see the rise of the far right, of nationalist movements. And at the same time, we are wondering what is the view of Twail, of the Global South, in combating and fighting back against this right of the far right. I personally think that the rise of the far right has certainly to do, if it comes to Europe, certainly to do something with the so-called refugee crisis. I don't like the word, the terminology refugee crisis. I rather refer to it as a refugee situation. But this situation that we have seen, this unprecedented situation, has given kanonen fodder to the right. They have exploited this particular misery of people who came from the Global South to accelerate their rise to power. Angela Merkel had opened the doors to the refugees and to show a Germany full of compassion. And I still stand by her decision that she did that, regardless of the fact if I share her political views and her party affiliation, which I don't.
Sure.
But I do respect her decision from 2015. As a son of refugees, that she decided to open the doors and to help and accommodate those refugees in need. But this again has led to the rise of the AfD, the Alternative für Deutschland, in Germany. So what I recognize in this particular rise of the far right is that we see that a writing of a very famous Italian academic and philosopher, namely Giorgio Agamben, proves to be true. Giorgio Agamben wrote a fascinating and spectacular piece that is called Homo Sacer. And in this piece, he's talking that he's using this old romantic figure of a person who is banished and outlawed by archaic laws. And this particular person who is a threat to the society can be killed by all means to sustain the livelihood of the society. And he refers to this figure by referring to it as in contemporary terms as the refugee. The refugee as the person that does not belong to the so-called healthy individual in our contemporary society. And we can do anything that we want, outlaw it and make it more vulnerable to make it basically an enemy to the society, to vilify it, to sustain the livelihood of the actual society upon which the survival of the nation stands.
Right.
So I see this reproducing, and Giorgio Agamben's analysis is painfully true, and it's excellently laid out by this great Italian academic. And when he speaks about Homo Sacer, we see this very same analysis applicable to the people who are trying to look for a better life, who are trying to cross the Mediterranean in boats, who are dying in the Mediterranean, which becomes the largest graveyard in the world. And the European Union, as the Nobel Peace Prize winner from a couple of years ago, is not acting according to its duties under not only the Nobel Peace Prize, but also under its duties under the Lisbon Treaty and various human rights treaties. So what I find interesting, and I try to discuss it with my students very often at Griffith College, is that we in the Western world, and this brings me back to your question, Matt, what is the view of the Global South? Coming from a background of the Global South, coming from originally Sri Lanka, coming from, you know, a very well-educated household with my father and my mother, I share the narrative of the Global South, but at the same time, I am also sharing learning from the view of the First World. Mm-hmm. Being, you know, born in Germany and also having studied in Germany and in the Netherlands, in Ireland, I breathe in as much knowledge from different parts of the world and try to make my more or less considerable opinion. And if I look at the discourse that we had in the Europe, on the European continent, I find it very interesting that many people, especially in this country, in Ireland, are vilifying and discriminating refugees who are, for one reason or the other, looking for a better life to come to Ireland or many other places of Europe, either because out of persecution or because of war. Mm-hmm. Or even just for economic reasons. Yes, okay. Also for economic reasons, which you know, reasons that don't fall under the 1951 Refugee Convention.
And of course,
Here in the in the Western world, we always try to look at those particular human beings. We look down at them. We try to make them objects. And as I had presented at a paper, as at a conference in Belfast last year, there's a particular connotation, a different language that we have used, in particular in the West through media. Katie Hopkins, which is, you know, she considers herself as a media personality. She's probably the British version to Tommy Lahren. She referred to refugees as vermins. Mm-hmm. David Cameron referred to refugees who were in Calais in France as a swarm. So dehumanizing human beings, and you see there a certain narrative that is reproducing through the words of Giorgio Agamben. But at the same time, Matt, we here in Europe, we forget about our own history, that many people put themselves on the boat seeking for a better life and to come to the United States of America. We here, in particular, I'm speaking of Ireland, forget that our forefathers and foremothers, I include myself in this narrative, embarked upon a very risky and dangerous journey to the United States in light of the Great Famine that has killed so many people in this country. And we forget all these histories, all these narratives, all these particular truths that has happened to the Western world, okay, the first world, people who left Europe to seek for a better life somewhere else. And now we are looking at people who are seeking for a better life coming from the global south, because there are certain instruments that are existing in our contemporary international political and legal world that are actually exploiting and reproducing the old inequalities of the world and entrenching those inequalities through mechanisms like the WTO, the World Trade Organization, but also the International Monetary Fund, but also through mechanisms like, you know, and regional organizations like the European Union. We forget that we have created the problems that we are complaining about now. Mm-hmm. After we have created the problems that we are facing, we are now pushing back the people from the global south, because our worldview is based within our own narrative without actually including the global south in evaluating, assessing the long-term impacts of our own policies that are haunting us now. Muthu Kumari Sonaraja is one of the famous representatives of the Twile Scholarship, and he is a professor in Singapore. He is originally from Sri Lanka. He is also from the Tamil ethnicity, a great mind and a great intellectual and academic, who is in particular a renowned expert in international investment law. And Muthu Kumari Sonaraja wrote a great piece on the aspect of how to create the idea of global justice for the global south. And he speaks about the corruption of the third world elite through Western powers that are wedding their own interests, but are alienating and marginalizing the vulnerable of their own countries, and actually causing more economic exploitation to the global south through corruption and practices of entrenching power of the elite, not only in the global south, but also in the west. And to this end, Anthony Yangi, another person that I had mentioned earlier, he argues that in this whole narrative, it's human rights that has served to liberate many parts of the world after the end of the Second World War. In particular, we use the right to self-determination as our way, as our weapon against the former colonizers, to completely making international law truly international. But at the same time, we see that the new institutions, the new hegemonic institutions, are using the language, at least, of human rights as a Trojan horse to further their own imperial goals, because they want the Global South to sign up the human rights treaties and to abide by human rights treaties. But at the same time, there is no actual follow-up mechanism. It's just only a language to encourage and further the trade that is only serving the powerful few. So with current mechanisms that are existing at the international level and the regional level, we are just only entrenching the old power inequalities. We are actually exacerbating the crisis and economic exploitation of the Global South. And with this, we are actually giving and paving the way for more migration flows, because people cannot live in situations where they are completely cut off the wealth of the people. And to this end, people are migrating. People want a better life. And nobody can say this is wrong. People want a better life. They want to feed their children. They want to take care of themselves. But if our own institutions that are dominated by Western powers are actually entrenching old inequalities, then we actually see a vicious cycle, namely that more migration is contributing to more rise of the right, because the right is feeding from fear by alienating and completely isolating the idea that the Western hegemony has actually contributed to this misery that we see in the world.
This analysis, which is so striking when it incorporates the view from the South, striking, I think, because it shows that what has been happening is not necessarily exceptional in recent times, but is part of this almost systemic. These international economic institutions and these institutions of international law sort of creating the very conditions under which authoritarianism can then flourish by sort of taking advantage of the of all of the peripheral byproducts and you know all of the violence and all of the sort of outcasting that goes on as a result of that. And so it seems like that, you know, it's almost as if these faux populist authoritarian revolts are complementary to these neoliberal institutions, and which is informative, because so many sort of liberal proponents of neoliberalism see that their worldview as an antidote to, you know, to this, this lack of democracy and this dehumanization. Yeah. So, you know, I tend to look at authoritarianism as global capital having a tantrum when challenged.
Yeah.
And those are those manifestations.
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit about various nodes of resistance that you see possible, maybe through using the best parts or the most promising parts of international law and international human rights advocacy, both institutionally and non-institutionally. I know that, for example, I don't know if this is related, but I know you and Regina deal in tribunals, people's tribunals. And are there things like that or other practices that, while imperfect, may offer some route of being able to build resistance and using some of the master's tools to dismantle or at least throw some hammers into the gears of the machine, because I know that sometimes TWAIL has been accused of nihilism, which is the, you know, sort of the last refuge of attack against all critical approaches, right? You're not articulating an alternative. It sounds like there are many alternatives. None of them are perfect, but there are many possibilities. Do you want to talk about that?
So, once you started there, I had to think of a meme that I saw the other day. Not a meme, but it was like a you know, a short story that was circulating around social media, which I think it went that a banker, a worker, and a refugee go into a bar. There are three cookies on the table. The banker takes away two of them and says, "Watch out! The refugee is after your last cookie there."
Hilarious.
And yeah, I found it interesting because it's if we look at the hyperventilation, this the way how people are angry at refugees for different reasons, that they are exploiting the social security system, that they are committing crime. Yes, they are. Among 100 refugees, there will be one or two. There was this infamous situation in Cologne a couple of years ago in Germany of sexual assault. There were a couple of other incidents all around the world. Obviously, there are one or two refugees who are certainly no Mahatma Gandhis. But I find it interesting that at every little incident, when we have problems, it's always the fingers pointed at the refugees, which is quite deplorable, but also interesting in light of the aforementioned study of Giorgio Agamben. But we also have to think of somebody of an incident in the past, like the Panama Papers. Think of the Cum-Ex files. We know that billionaires, millionaires are hoarding billions and millions of euro and dollars in offshore accounts somewhere in the Caribbean and somewhere else on the Cayman Islands. And yet our focus, whenever there is a slightest inconvenience, are refugees. I find it highly despicable and problematic that we are not discussing issues like that of unequal wealth distribution and the people who are actually exploiting the system and further putting people, especially the workers, at peril. And this is what, you know, I'm trying to echo what you said earlier. Neoliberalism is creating the conditions of exploitation, and capitalism, as it is actually giving rise to racism and authoritarian leadership and the shift and the move and the rise of the global right. I find that rather problematic, not only problematic, but highly worrying, and fearing for any democratic society that is under this condition right now. But coming back to your question, you know, what are the countermeasures of TWILE? Well, I was asked this question at another conference that I attended last year in Dublin, but also before that in Edinburgh, because I had laid out my view or our view of TWILE as a counter-hegemonic approach to international law. And everybody asked, well, this is a quite striking and interesting analysis, Tamil, but what are your solutions? What do you want to do? Well, most of our scholars from the TWILE movement are Marxists. They have a particular view on the world as it stands today. They are asking for redistribution of wealth. They asking for redistribution of power. And what we are in particular asking is for justice. And I think justice is our central piece of countermeasure to and to overcome the rise of racism, nationalism, and authoritarian leadership. I think that mechanisms like the Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights of the United Nations can be developed further through different articles that are existing in its covenant, in particular through individual complaints. We can exploit more on the United Nations Special Rapporteur mechanisms of the United Nations Human Rights Council to shed light on inequality. And as a matter of fact, I mean, it's very interesting to mention all that, Matt. I have recently published a piece with the Irish Studies in International Affairs on the United Nations after a very painful few months. And believe me, if you are an early stage academic or an academic at any stage, going through a peer-reviewed journal for approval of your academic article is definitely not an easy walk in the park. But I've managed this, published it, and in this piece, my reviewers criticized, because I wrote this piece on the United Nations, my reviewers criticized that I was arguing for abolishing the United Nations, which is not true. I never argued for abolishing the United Nations. And also my PhD, which dealt with the United Nations human rights engagement with Sri Lanka, I've never argued for abolishing the United Nations, not at all. What I was arguing is that we have to recapture the overarching narrative that comes from the Global South. What I'm arguing for is that we need to exploit the existing mechanisms and develop them further to implement the idea of global justice within the existing mechanisms. And one of them, as I mentioned earlier, not only the Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights of the United Nations, another important mechanism is the United Nations Special Procedure, namely the United Nations Special Rapporteurs. The United Nations Special Rapporteurs are independent experts, and one of our scholars is working within this mandate. It's Mr. Okafor, who is professor in law in Canada. Very interestingly, the current United Nations Special Rapporteur, Philip Alston, is the United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights. And Mr. Right. Philip Alston is from Australia. Mm-hmm. And Mr. Philip Alston is also teaching at NYU in the United States of America. And Philip Alston, again, is a great academic. I really appreciate and admire his work. And I listened to his speech here in Dublin that he gave in November. And very interestingly, he made a sentence. He said that at the beginning of his mandate, and you know, don't pin me down when his mandate started as the United Nations Special Rapporteur, when he was appointed. But he said, when I started as United Nations Special Rapporteur on Extreme Poverty and Human Rights, the word neoliberalism was a word that I have never used before. And I found it striking that this man, experienced with so many books written and articles written and so many media appearances and many academic positions that this man held, that this man said that he has never used the word neoliberalism before more than now. And he says, in light of neoliberalism, in face of cuttings, of cuts to public spending on public welfare, on social welfare, ushered in the era of the 21st century through neoliberal practices, we see a widening of the poor and the rich. And he wrote an incredible report after his visit to the United Kingdom last year. He visited the United Kingdom, and he had asserted, in light of austerity measures in the country, that there is a widening gap between the poor and the rich. And this austerity measures is a further marginalizing the global, the poor in the country, but in particular, vulnerable society, vulnerable minorities in the country, such as refugees, such as other disadvantaged groups like disabled. And his analysis was striking. And I think a mechanism like the United Nations Special Rapporteur, in particular on extreme poverty and human rights, a mechanism like the United Nations Human Rights, the United Nations Committee on Economic, Social, and Cultural Rights, but also United Nations Human Rights Committee, which is the monitoring body of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. All these treaty-based and charter-based bodies have actually the capacity and the power to overcome inequalities, and we can use those mechanisms, build in those mechanisms to give voice to the vulnerable people of this planet, to build in resistance, social resistance against the encroaching practices of the global elite and the practices of neoliberalism. And I also believe that we should further exploit and capitalize upon the International Court of Justice, which is the judicial organ of the United Nations. Mm-hmm. It is not per se a human rights court. It isn't. But we have seen on different levels, in different cases, that the International Court of Justice could be exploited and exhausted as a mechanism to achieve justice for vulnerable societies. And I'm in particular thinking of the advisory opinion on the wall in Palestine, where the International Court of Justice has rightly pointed out the different human rights treaties and the violation of human rights treaties. Our argument is that if we want to achieve a redistribution of wealth, and if we want to give a larger platform to the global south, we need to build resistance into the law, in international law. And the current mechanisms at the United Nations level are giving us different room to achieve so. But we should also recapture areas of international institutions like a body like the World Trade Organization or the International Monetary Fund, which, strangely enough, are always met going between the United States and Europe. All the heads of the IMF and the WTO and the World Bank were bareheaded and led by the United States and and Europe. And we need to overcome those narratives also at the institutional level to build in resistance and actually give voice to the global south. So, you know, finalizing my thought here, I do think that resistance can be built in by using the existing mechanisms to shape the law through the committees, through the United Nations Special Rapporteurs, but also through a body like the International Court of Justice, the United Nations General Assembly, which can issue resolutions, which can develop a long-standing or reflect a long-standing practice. And to this end, we are giving voice to people from the ground to echo their concerns and translate into resistance that actually leads into effective changes of international law. So it is not an ideal, it's not a utopic practice that I'm talking about. And it's not a
nihilistic. But it's not nihilistic either. You're naming all these things, and I'm like, this doesn't sound anything remotely like nihilism to me.
No.
It almost sounds pragmatic.
Exactly. So,
from a different angle, and from a very critical angle, and one that is crying for justice and for bottom-up justice. But nevertheless, you are, you know, you it doesn't sound like you're, you know, wanting to burn those particular institutions down at all.
No. We don't want to burn down Rome. That's not our intention. What we are trying to do is restructuring international law, and we want to rebuild the foundations of the international institutions And we are asking for our equal share in global power at the international institutions. And we are doing that also through the practices of international law at the different mechanisms that I have listed. As you just said, Matt, let me refer to another great scholar of international law and the Twile movement, and that's Professor B.S. Chimney from India. And Professor Chimney has written, as the first Twile scholar, his piece was published in the American Journal in International Law, which was quite revolutionary that for the first time a Twile scholar, a scholar from the Global South, found a platform in a Western paper to echo his view. As you are giving me the modest chance to echo our concerns from the Global South, the American Journal for International Law gave the chance to Professor Chimney. And he wrote a magnificent piece there where he talked about the development of international customary law, which is one of the sources of international law. And customary international law as it stands today, again, is a product of international, of colonialism, that has translated as one source of international law. If we, in particular, look at the law of the sea, largely the law of the sea is customary international law. But it was defined as customary international law by the dominating colonial powers because they were sailing from one place to the other to colonize us, the people in Sri Lanka or Australia or in South Africa. We never asked anybody to come. They came and they formed the law of the sea. And this law of the sea is now considered to be customary international law practice. And Professor Chimney is pointing out to different facets of the development of customary international law. And he's proposing another aspect of resistance. Customary international law as it stands consists of two elements, namely state practice, but also the belief in the state practice, which was formed by Western powers. And Professor Chimney is asking for another idea to include within this, and he is asking for not only state practice and opinio iuris, the belief in the state practice, he's also asking to further specialize, namely to say there's opinio iuris communitas, namely we believe in the practice of the community, of the people, and we need to give voice to the people from the ground, from non-governmental organizations, from indigenous communities, from women's organizations, and many more to actually create a law that comes from the bottom to the top rather than from the top to the bottom. So it's a revolutionary idea that Professor Chimney is taking, but it is logical that international law, jus gentium, in German we say Völkerrecht, is the law of the peoples. That if it's the law of the peoples, then we have to give the voice to the people. People like the people in Brazil who are fearing the attack on their natural habitat in indigenous areas in the country. I'm talking about indigenous communities in at Standing Rock. I'm talking about women who are marginalized after the end of the civil war in Sri Lanka. I'm talking about refugees in Sicily who don't have access to actual political participation. We need to give voice to those people. We need to give voice to people who are actually the subject of international law rather than the object of international law. And as it stands today, we are giving the room rather to the global elite that is furthering its own interests rather than supporting the interests of the people.
After that great conversation with Tamil, I was reflecting on how this very series, Human Rights in a Burning World, proceeds from recognition that the world is breaking. Maybe it's broken. Maybe it's always been broken. And I was thinking, this is where the heroism emerges. And then I learned that my friend Jairus Grove had finished his book. The book is called Savage Ecologies.
He teaches political science at the University of Hawaii. And he does this thing called future studies, where you postulate futures, usually political futures. And you study the assumptions and the paradigms that give rise to those futures. He's well-versed in international law and international relations, and, like Tamil, is deeply skeptical of international institutions. But wait till you hear what he says about joy, including finding joy in resistance.
My name is Jairus Grove. I'm the director of the Hawaii Research Center for Future Studies. I'm also an associate professor of international relations in the Department of Political Science at the University of Hawaii. And my book is called Savage Ecology, War and Geopolitics at the End of the World. It's an effort to try to understand the last 500 years of the geological era of our Earth as a project of war and settler colonialism, as opposed to just a crisis of carbon. And I think in that, we see both possibilities for new ways of viewing politics and also new possibilities for striving together to make better lives and worlds.
We're taught a lot to think about the world, or we have been taught for the last several decades to think about the world in terms of first world, second world, and third world. What do you feel like some of the, or maybe some of the insights and revelations in your book about how we might re-examine or reconfigure those types of classifications?
Yeah. I mean, the first thing I want to say is we often forget about the fourth world, which are people that were neither kind of lumped into post-colonial state system of the third world after World War II, nor were they part of the highly industrialized states, which were coming out of World War II. They were indigenous peoples who were stuck in between, and were spread throughout the world and wanted to make very different claims to modernization and even internationalization. And for instance, those states who were part of, say, for instance, the Bandung Conference, right? Who wanted to try to configure a non-aligned movement during the Cold War. There was an even more non-aligned movement that often was left out of international law and international politics, which is only just now getting on the agenda of places like the UN. So that would be sort of the first thing that I'd want to say. The other is that I don't think geography scales in north-south distinctions that well anymore, right? We have pockets of hyper wealth and exploitation in every portion of the planet. And we have extraordinary, just intense processes of immiseration and sadism in nearly every part of the planet. And the distribution of those are uneven. So in what we think of as the global south geographically, we certainly have more intensifications of poverty. But even in the United States and in Europe, you know, whether it's the U.S.-Mexico border, we have thousands of kids in cages, or it's Detroit that's under nearly privatized management and can't get basic needs, right? These processes of sort of north-south are sort of scattered now, right? They don't follow clear lines. And part of what my book's trying to look at is why that isn't the story that we tell about globalization, right? So we tend to tell a story that's either, well, globalization is terrible because of capital, which, you know, true, or globalization is great because of capital. And we don't tend to think as much about the ways in which it's a much longer process. We're not talking about globalization since, you know, say, the end of World War II. We're really talking about globalization for the last 500 years. And that was about fracturing communities, breaking up peoples, forcibly mobilizing and moving them, sometimes leveraging them to do horrible things. I mean, one of the things that I try to draw attention to in the book is that I had this concept I call the Eurocene, which is, instead of calling it the Anthropocene, where humans have made a planet, we're really talking about a vanguard of elites in Europe making a geological era. Now, it was vanguard driven, but the reality is they also used the leveraged poverty of Ireland so that there would be enough settlers to unleash on the West in the United States. They used forms of, you know, debt bondage to carry out settlement. So it's hard to make the sort of traditional ways that we would be much easier to think about things like class as being the major sort of bifurcating moment, or geography as being the nice cleavage point in which we could draw these distinctions. Part of the way this project, the Eocene, has worked has been using those cleavages in sometimes very cruel creative ways, right? So using class as a form of settlement against other classes, right, that weren't industrial at all, or leveraging what were necessary humanitarian actions to erode sovereignty of states and sabotage governments, right? That these kinds of processes have left us with a much more complex and difficult world than most of the conceptual tools we have to tell these stories.
Obviously, cruelty is something that runs across your analysis in the book. Is cruelty gratuitous? Is it functional? Or is there an even different way to think about it?
A few times in the book, I talk about what I call a general economy of sadism, which is, I think violence can be incredibly instrumental. I think it can serve functionalist ends, but it's not the limit of violence, right? So we tend to think that instrumentality or functionality is a kind of almost control or like a net, right? So don't worry, states, they can be really violent, but they'll always act in their own self-interest, right? This is the kind of mantra of political realism in international relations. I don't think that's true. And in fact, it's one of my major gripes with a certain kind of reading of Marx as well, in the sense that, you know, there are these kinds of limits which a kind of doctrinaire Marxism puts a lot of faith in, that there will be certain kinds of contradictions which will create limits for capital and crises in legitimacy and moments of galvanization. There are also certain kinds of limits in Marx, and the one that's most important to me right now is sort of the idea of the falling rate of profit, right? That Marxism will reach this kind of, or rather capitalism will reach this kind of wall because of its inability to create new capital. And I think one of the things that if you really look closely at a 500-year process, which some Marxists do, you know, Wallerstein, Arrighi, these people will look at what they call the longue durée. But one of the things that I think they don't take seriously enough is, you know, it was 150 years of settler colonialism before any profit was turned, which really begs the question, well, what exactly were they doing? Well, they were murdering and raping and civilizing and building a certain kind of self-image. And I don't think that that economy of value makes sense purely in capitalist terms. Right. So I think that the productivity of capitalism creates the resources capable of that kind of mass violence. But it's not a sufficient explanation for where the desire comes from that drives just mass tragedy and cruelty. And I do think that that becomes an economy in itself. And it's one of the reasons I'm quite taken with this new Marxist collective out of England. Their journal is called Salvage. And their catchphrase is "Bleak is the new red." Which I like to. And, you know, kind of their take is, what if we loosen up a little bit on these categories, right? We keep the same spirit of Marx, but we realize that sadism can become its own kind of economy. I mean, this is what anthropologists and philosophers like George Bataille were talking about kind of in the immediate aftermath of World War II. And further, like, shouldn't we still be good Marxists even if the revolution isn't every possible? Right, a commitment to universal human dignity, a commitment to solidarity shouldn't be purely instrumental either. So I think that there's also a temptation when you start to explain Marxism as a kind of instrumentality as well, right? Why should we be good Marxists? Well, because it'll just be a better world, or it's the most effective means for overturning capitalism, or because there's sort of necessary rational contradictions that, you know, Marxism isn't really a choice, it's really just an outcome. The reason why I like Salvage is their position is more like, well, even if the ship's going down, wouldn't we rather be hugging each other than murdering each other? That only comes when, you know, at the bleakest moments, at the scarcest moments, when you don't want a form of socialization that hits us against one another. And to me, that seems like the more sort of vital legacy of Marxism than what I think is increasingly a dated reading of political economy.
Talk about a little bit about international law, and particularly want to ask you what role or any role lies for international bodies and international oriented advocates in kind of your vision of what is hopeful and useful, and also kind of what how students of international law might read your book.
I think, you know, like all things, I'll paraphrase the old Foucault line. It's not that everything is good or bad. It's that everything is dangerous, right? Danger is both a good thing and a bad thing, right? So I think international law is probably one of the best examples of that. And in part because international law is too many different things, right? So there's a huge difference between the international law of the WTO and the kind of Bretton Woods system and the way that that regulatory framework works and the kind of aspirational international law that's built into the original sort of birth of the UN Charter pre-Security Council or some of the aspirational goals of things like the International Criminal Court or other ways in which the international can be configured. So I tend to like the aspirational side, even though I'm not a big hope guy. I like the kinds of communities that builds, right? So if hope isn't about like holding out for something better, if hope is about collective striving, building community, finding new forms of life or ways to live, then I think that's an important role that international law can play in finding those kinds of transnational connections where there are already affinities for better ways of living, right? Not a better form of life in the future, but in the present, better forms of living. Mm-hmm. The dangerous razor's edge side is that international law has often had trouble abandoning its kind of Kantian, Hegelian roots, where the success of international law is when it becomes truly global, right? When there's kind of no outside of it, where everyone's a part of it, where you have sort of full compliance and participation. And that view of international law scares me a bit, right? It's a bit too much like the homogenization, which I think is at the bedrock of a very dangerous version of the Euro scene. The inability for people to opt out without being an enemy or a rogue state, the inability for tolerating not just differences, but radical differences, people who don't want to participate, people who want to be left alone, people who want to find other ways of being in the world that's not a global world. That's, I think, still a really big struggle for the vision of international law. We only tend to articulate those forms of distancing from international law as unilateralism, right? We think about them the way that we criticize people like George W. Bush and Donald Trump, but there are also those people for whom international law hasn't ever proven that there's something that can be trusted. And I think being able to have a kind of dual approach where we understand that not every version of self-determination and desire for local control is like every other form, right? Where we can no longer equate, you know, cattle militias in the Pacific Northwest with, you know, Lakota Sioux in the middle of Minnesota, right? Those aren't the same desires for self-governance, and they come from very different places and very different relationships to privilege. And also, they bear dangers in a very different way. And I similarly think that that's true of, you know, African-American populations who reached out to the United Nations during the 1960s. I mean, people forget that Black Panthers were not an insular national movement. They had a grand international vision, and the UN didn't do too much. I think, you know, I think about people like Anne-Marie Slaughter, or these very robust visions of what international law and international norms can be. And I think it's a bit tone deaf for how people who've been waiting around for a better international law for generations feel when someone says, oh, well, if you just committed to this global cosmopolitanism, don't you realize things would be better? And the answer is, well, we did that like in the 1940s and you didn't really give us decolonization. We did that again in the 1960s and you didn't show up for our movements. And we did it again in the 1980s. We wanted nuclear-free zones. you prioritized other things. And so I think it's important to remember that we don't get to start over every time we want to remake the world. We bear the whole history of those power relations. The last thing I sort of talk about in the seventh chapter of the book is the way this is happening again around geoengineering and climate change, where, you know, this is another example where this strange combination of pessimism and hope is quite dangerous. So we're pessimistic about real constraints on carbon, but we're vastly optimistic about technological solutions for altering the weather patterns on the planet, which to me is hilarious. We think we can manage an entire planet, but we can't mobilize political movements in countries to cut emissions, right? Mm-hmm. Well, you know, the reality is that those kinds of technologies will not affect the planet equally. And if they are managed by international law, they will also not be governed equally, because the majority of the planet isn't represented in, you know, the Security Council. And the real teeth of international law, because our international law still has teeth, and they're long and sharp, right? They're nuclear powers, right, that have those teeth. So, you know, those tend to be in very particular places, and they tend to benefit from geoengineering in very particular ways. And if I'm a country in the global south, in Central America, or I'm a country in the Pacific, like sovereign people of Hawaii, or the, you know, independent nation of Guam, then I'm worried that there's going to be famines because geoengineering will dry things out, and no one on the Security Council is going to really care because we're just not enough people to matter, right? That's the kind of concern I have. So I think we need to be more serious when we talk about being critical international legal scholars, about really how much work we have to do to reimagine what that looks like. I don't really think of myself as a hopeful person. I like the affect of joy a lot more than I like the affect of hope. So there are a lot of things that I find joy in. And the reason why I think joy is more valuable is that hope can be mobilized very easily for conservative ends. It's amazing how quickly hope gets instrumentalized. So if something becomes possible, right, if it's a kind of hope for something not here yet, then the things that we're willing to kind of throw under the bus in the short term in hopes of getting to that hope are it's a long list. It's not a good one on the left or the right. Whereas I tend to think that joy, because of the way in which it exists in the present and the way in which I think it almost always exists collectively, right, it's very hard to be entirely joyful by yourself. Even when you're joyful by yourself, it's certainly because you're in the world. Mm-hmm. There's something in the world that's making you joyful. And unlike hope, I don't think joy can be disappointed. One can be actually quite joyful, even in the worst of conditions. You know, I'm reading Sadia Hartman's new book now, which is this remarkable account of a period of American Black urban life that actually academics know all too well, because it's like the birth of modern sociology, right? And so we have all these books on the death of the family in Black America, and, you know, the gut-wrenching nature of ghetto poverty and the very notion of ghettoization and, you know, what it means to have this sort of slave culture. And what she brings to life are all the people that were only objects in the book, who were making new kinds of families, new kinds of queer relationships, new kinds of culture and music. For whom that isn't a disproving of just how gut-wrenching the poverty in, say, Philadelphia or New York was. It's how incapable that very weaponized poverty was in destroying joy. So there are lots of things that make me joyful. You know, the fact that I have feral roosters and chickens all over my backyard makes me joyful. The fact that my children are already imagining new kinds of worlds they want to build makes me incredibly joyful. I don't talk about it in the book, but I sort of underwriting the book, I have always been much more taken with Foucault's notions of heterotopias than the idea of a utopia, right? A utopia is a no place. It's something we're supposed to strive for. Heterotopias are these discordant, seemingly impossible worlds you create in the world now. Right? The things that ought not exist, ought not survive, ought not thrive, given all the rules of capital, geopolitics, and cruelty, and yet they thrive nonetheless. And I would like to see a left that's more committed to that kind of thriving, and more skeptical of the kind of grand narratives of the left, which are about, say, sustainability or completely transforming the market, not just because I don't think those things are possible. I mean, maybe they are, maybe they aren't, but I would only want to get there if it looks like this kind of sociality the whole way through. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And for me, that's really important. so that the hope doesn't turn into what Lauren Berlant has called a cruel optimism, right? Where not only do we bear the weight of having to change the world, which can be quite exhausting at the point of death for a lot of activists, but also that we don't wait, right? We don't wait to make the world that we'd want, right? We just do it. I don't need hope because, you know, joy is invigorating and it's powerful, and the immediacy of joy over the temporality of hope.
This has been the second full episode of our series, Human Rights in a Burning World, produced in cooperation with the Common Good Foundation and sponsored by World Peace Through Law section of the Washington State Bar Association. You can support the series by going to the podcast page at actwithus.org, more specifically www.actwithus.org/category/podcast. There's a donation link there, and your support will help us create episodes in the coming months about fights against human trafficking, tribunals on organ harvesting, sexual abuse, the ongoing struggle for a right to health and other socioeconomic rights, and efforts to empower communities in Haiti, Iran, and elsewhere. For Solidarity House Cooperative, I'm Matt Stannard.